Okay. We're going to be talking tonight about the reform of the church that Pope Francis wants to bring about. He wants to totally revolutionize the church, giving it a freshness. We're not starting from scratch, but we're trying to renew what's there. And tonight what I'd like to do in about 45 minutes is talk about 10 particular aspects of that reform, 10 challenges given us to us all as individual disciples, but also our parishes and the church as a whole. 19 months ago, when Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio of Buenos Aires, Argentina, was elected the 265th successor of St. Peter, he was elected precisely to bring about a reform. 3 days after he was elected, he had an audience with the journalists who were there in Rome to cover the conclave, and he joked that when he was elected, he was telling all the other cardinals he was going to take the name Hadrian the Seventh, because Hadrian the Sixth had been pope 500 years ago, after Martin Luther had hammered the 95 theses on Wittenberg Cathedral's door, and he was the great reforming pope. He didn't take the name of Hadrian the Seventh, thanks be to God, it doesn't sound all that good. He chose the name, though, of the greatest reformer in the history of the church, Giovanni Francesco Bernardone, who, when he was in his mid-20s, heard Jesus speaking to him from a crucifix in the dilapidated church dedicated to St. Damian on the hillside of Assisi, saying, "Francis, rebuild my church that you can see is falling into ruins." Francis originally thought that what the Lord was asking was to repair that dilapidated edifice on the side of a hill. But the Lord had a much bigger building project in mind, because the church is not made out of fundamentally marble, wood, bricks, and glass, but out of men, women, boys, and girls, what St. Peter will call living stones, built on Christ, the cornerstone. And that's the reform that Francis carried out in the church, and that's a similar reform to what Pope Francis is trying to accomplish, to reach every living stone in the church, to strengthen the church from its foundation up. To reform means literally to reshape. And over the last 19 months, Pope Francis has been seeking to form the entire people of God to be more aligned to the gospel. What I'd like to do tonight is to cover 10 of those most significant reforms he's been talking about that are meant to impact not just the church universal, but our parishes, our families, our neighborhoods, and our day-to-day Catholic lives. I prepared a little bit of a cheat sheet for everybody, just so that you know how close I am to the end. So I'd encourage you to follow it as we go together. But the first big challenge, his main challenge, is to help all of us get out of our comfort zones and bring the gospel to those on the outskirts of life. 6 days before he was elected, he gave a history-changing intervention, it was called, a 4-minute and 44-second speech to his brother cardinals in what was called the General Congregations. Before the conclave happens, all the cardinals get together in a closed session, and they all talk about what they think the needs of the church are and what the job description of the next pope should be. They're given a 5-minute limit because nothing's really new to any of these cardinals. They follow the situation very closely, but they just need to know what the priorities of their brothers are. But most of the cardinals like to hear themselves speak. And so instead of speaking for 5 minutes, they'll go on for 15 or 25 or 35 or more. Cardinal Bergoglio got up, and he spoke for 4 minutes and 44 seconds, which said he respected his brothers, and they all appreciated the brevity. But he spoke with an incredible depth, and he spoke in beautiful Italian. Everybody had thought that at 76 years old, with half a functioning lung, he was a has-been who would never be elected pope, because they were looking for somebody on the south side of 70. Because we had had the previous over 25 years of popes who were over 75. But he preached with a real vigor. And so they turned to the Archbishop of Cuba, Havana, Cuba, Cardinal Jaime Ortega, and they said, "Could you get a copy of his talk?" His talk was so good and was so deep that they wanted to study it. And so Cardinal Ortega went to Cardinal Bergoglio and said, "Everybody's asking for a talk. Could I make some photocopies of what you were speaking about?" And Cardinal Bergoglio turned around a sheet of paper that looked like this, and there were three bullets and just three words. That was his entire talk. He had gone off the cuff, a braccio, they say in Italian, right? Off the arm. And so Ortega went back to all the other cardinals and said, "He did that off the cuff." So they were very impressed by that. But the next morning at breakfast, Cardinal Bergoglio went to Cardinal Ortega and he said, "Jaime, please make photocopies of this and give it to anybody who asked." And they said, "What's this?" "Well, last night I sat down and I rewrote from my memory what I tried to say yesterday. It's almost exactly what I would have said." So when he finally made those photocopies and brought it to the other cardinals, they were impressed at his charity for his brothers. So all of this started to change. They started to realize that he had something to give. They really liked his message. They liked his charity toward them in both ways. And so they started to notice. But what was the substance of what he said that they so desperately wanted to get a copy of? He described that the future pope and the church led by him needed to heed Jesus' call to evangelize those on what he called the peripheries of existence, who are alienated from God and others through sin or pain or injustice or ignorance or ideology or material or spiritual poverty or other types of misery. And he said that the chief corruption in the church happens when we lose our apostolic zeal, when we cease getting outside of our parish buildings and bringing the gospel to those who aren't coming, when the church becomes, as an institution, self-referential, just thinking about those who are coming rather than those who aren't, if we're paying the bills, if we've got a good roof, etc. When the church becomes self-referential, Cardinal Bergoglio says the church becomes sick. He said the evils that happen over the course of time inside the church have their root in a self-reference. And he says, in a sort of theological narcissism. Narcissism means we keep looking at our own reflection. A theological narcissism is we're so focused in theology just about what the church is that we forget about who God is. We forget about how he died for everybody out there. So he says, that's the chief root of every evil that infects the church, that we begin to take ourselves too seriously. And we downgrade the seriousness with which we treat the mission Jesus has given to us. He said that the next pope needed to be a man who, from his prayer, from his contemplation and adoration of Jesus Christ, helps the church get outside of herself to the existential peripheries, who helps her to become a fruitful mother, living off the sweet and comforting joy of evangelizing, of sharing the gospel. That job description was one that his brother cardinals evidently thought he met. In his apostolic exhortation, The Joy of the Gospel, that he wrote for all of us last November, it contained the program for his pontificate. And in it, he gave his "I Have a Dream" speech. What was that "I Have a Dream"? "I dream," he wrote, "of a missionary impulse capable of transforming everything, so that the church's customs, ways of doing things, times and schedules, language and structure can be suitably channeled for the evangelization of today's world rather than for her self-preservation." He called all Catholic institutions and all Catholics to this transformation. And that's certainly a big challenge. First involves service to those who are neglected. He said in his inaugural homily as Pope that we in our church must open our arms to embrace with tender affection all of humanity, but especially the poorest, the weakest, the least important, those whom Matthew lists in his final judgment on love, the hungry, the thirsty, the naked, the stranger, the ill, the imprisoned. Those, in short, that most in the world think last about. We first need to go out for these people. But it also involves, he says, sharing the gospel with others. Because the worst discrimination against the poor, he said, is lack of spiritual care. And then our preferential option for those on the outskirts must translate into a preferential religious care. When he was in Assisi last October, he said, "What a great spiritual poverty is when the kid next door doesn't even know how to make the sign of the cross. that we don't have to go to Papua New Guinea to find those who are on these outskirts. Some of the times they're on our same block. The sharing of the gospel is supposed to be a passion for any one of us who knows and loves Jesus and shares his love for others. He wrote in that exhortation, "What kind of love would not feel the need to speak of the beloved, to point him out, to make him known? We're convinced from personal experience," he said, "that it's not the same thing to have known Jesus as not to have known him. It's not the same thing to walk with Jesus as to walk blindly. It's not the same thing to hear his word as not to hear it. It's not the same thing to contemplate him, worship him, find our peace in him as not to. We know well that with Jesus life becomes richer, and that with him it's easier to find meaning in everything. This is why we evangelize," he wrote. Speaking about the first reform needed, he said before he was a pope, "I believe that a church that reduces itself to administration, to guarding a small flock, is a church that in the long run has become sick. The pastor who locks himself in his rectory is not an authentic pastor of the sheep, but a sheep dresser who makes curls with the sheep's hair instead of really looking out after others." If we're trying to imitate the Good Shepherd, Jesus, we're going to go out in search of these lost sheep. Last June, he told members of the church in Rome, "There's a beautiful passage of the gospel which tells about the shepherd who, when he returned to the sheepfold, realized that one of the sheep was missing. And so he left the other 99 and went in search of that lost sheep. Brothers and sisters," he said, "we have one sheep. We've lost the other 99. We must go out. We must go out to find them. In this culture, let's speak the truth, we only have one. We're a minority. Do we feel the fervor, the apostolic zeal to go out after the 99? And in Rome, he's exaggerating a little bit, but in Rome only 7% of people come to church. Here in Massachusetts, 17% of people come to church. So we need to leave the 17 and go out after the 83. But those are just Catholics, and Catholics are just 47%. Then we have to go out for the others, especially those who don't know Jesus at all in their life. And that's got to become a passion," he's saying. If we don't have that burning passion to go share Jesus with others, he says, we're sick as Catholics. And he wants to bring us to healing. That's the first reform. That we need not just to focus on what's going well, but on what needs to improve. I want to tell you a little story. A couple years back, I went to Sugar Land, Texas, very close to Houston, to preach a Lenten mission. There were 9 masses, 5 in English, 4 in Spanish. The church fit 1,100 people, and every single mass was standing room only. It was unbelievable. At the end of preaching a half hour for 9 straight masses, including 4 times in Spanish, I was pretty wasted. And the pastor there said to me, "Rog, you look like you need a drink." I said, "Bart, you are a very perceptive priest." So he fixed me a drink. We went out into his backyard. It was in April. It was a very nice night. And I said, "Bart, I just really need to congratulate you. I have never seen anything like this. We gave out 10,000 communions this weekend." He was smoking a cigar at the time. And like a Texan, he was smoking it really slowly. Took a long whiff and long exhalation. He said, "Well, Roger, the thing that keeps me up at night is Catholics are only 44% in Sugar Land. And those were only about 20% of the Catholics in this area. There are so many people who aren't coming to church. And I'm still trying to figure out how we're going to be able to build a church 5 to 10 times bigger when I start doing my job." It was a very impressive thing. His collection was $35,000 every single Sunday. He had built a brand new Catholic school designed by the greatest Catholic architect in the country. It would have been very easy for him to just sit back, lift up his feet and say, sing in Paradisum because I have just died and gone to heaven. But he didn't, because he cared about those who weren't coming. That's the reform that Pope Francis is saying we've all got to feel. Second challenge is for us first to proclaim what he calls the kerygma, rather than make the preaching of the gospel seem as if the church is just passing on a disjointed multitude of doctrines. What does that mean? When St. Paul writes in his first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 15, I have passed on to you as of the greatest importance of all what I myself have received. And then he describes all that Christ did. He came, he preached, he died, he rose, etc. That's the kerygma. It's the Greek word for proclamation. It's the essential announcement of who Jesus is and what he did. He said, we've got to focus on preaching that first and above all, because many people in our culture think they know the Catholic faith as a whole list of thou shalt nots, rather than as the greatest yes that's ever been proclaimed in the world. Pope Francis says this is the kerygma we need to announce to people today. Jesus Christ loves you. He gave his life to save you. And now he's living at your side every day to enlighten, strengthen, and free you. This is not, unfortunately, what the church always announces or what the people hear. He says we're supposed to be inviting people into a great stream of joy flowing from Jesus' overflowing heart. But instead, many Christians talk about the faith, he says, as if it were an experience of Lent without Easter. Or as if they look as if they're perpetually returning home from a funeral. He said, in today's world of instant communications and occasionally biased media coverage, I think he was being charitable there, occasionally biased media coverage, the message we proclaim runs a greater risk of being distorted or reduced to some of its secondary aspects. In this way, certain issues that are part of the church's moral teaching are taken out of context, which gives them their meaning. The biggest problem, he says, is when the message we preach seems identified with these secondary aspects, which, important as they are, do not in and of themselves convey the heart of Christ's message. So a lot of the times, the people, when they look at the church, think that we're just a pro-life organization, or that we're against artificial contraception, or that we're defending marriage as Jesus made it. And all of that's true. We are pro-life and we are pro-marriage. But there's so much more to this. And a lot of the times when they only hear those aspects of our teaching without the bigger yes about who Christ is, they're not going to have the strength or really the enthusiasm to embrace the message. A lot of the times in the secular media, this has been distorted. They'll say, Pope Francis says you shouldn't be preaching about any of these controversial issues. That's not what Pope Francis is saying at all, but what Pope Francis is saying is, if you're going to preach 10 times, you preach about that once. You don't preach about it 9 times. Because people have got to hear the great gift of our faith first. I mean, there's a reason why I don't walk into a cocktail party and say, hi, my name's Father Landry. You're not on the pill, are you? Right? Right? I mean, how effective would that be? But a lot of the times, that's what people hear. That's what people hear. We want to bring people to conversion, to alignment fully with the Lord's truth. But, you know, when Jesus calls us to pluck out eyes, or chop off hands, or chop off feet when they're leading us into sin, they have to have a real trust in Jesus first before they're ever going to do something like that. And if it seems like we're starting in preaching the gospel by plucking out your eye or chopping off your hand, we're not going to have people breaking down our church door to get in. That's the second thing that he's talking about. To make sure we both live the faith as good news, that we experience the joy that comes from Jesus' constant accompaniment, from his heroic gift of saving our life, and that we announce that joy first to others, so that they're able to see the no's as the flip sides to these great yeses. The third challenge to overcome, he says, is the cancer of clericalism in the church, which is a cancer that affects not just priests. What's clericalism? Clericalism means fundamentally focusing on the things of the clergy, and more specifically, the things of the sanctuary, rather than bringing the gospel out to the world. In a 2011 interview with the Argentine Catholic News Agency, he said that this contagious spiritual sickness comes from a clericalism that passes from clergy to laity. He said, "We priests tend to clericalize the laity. We don't realize it, but it's as if we're infecting them with our own disease. And the laity, not all but many, ask us on their knees to clericalize them, because it's more comfortable to be an altar server than a protagonist on a truly lay path. We can't fall into that trap. It's a sinful complicity." What does he mean? That in some places, lay people have gotten the understanding, because priests have basically focused on this, that where we really need lay help in the church is we need Eucharistic ministers, we need lectors, we need ushers, we need people to help out as sacristans. All of that, we do need some volunteer work there. But that's not the mission of the laity. The mission of the laity, Pope Francis is saying, is to go out and totally transform the world. To be the salt of the earth, to be the light of the world, to be leaven in every workplace, in every school, on every street corner. That's the real mission of the laity, to transform the world. And sometimes, because priests are so focused on making the parish run well, that they're focusing everybody's attention on the help that we need inside the walls, whereas lay people, fundamentally, are those who are supposed to take it to places priests and missionaries proper are never going to go. You've got friends in book clubs that a priest is never going to meet. You've got family members who are distant because whatever, at some point they were hurt by the church. You're going to be the person who's going to be able to bring them Jesus far more than a cleric would. But we need this revolution so that everything's moving outward rather than collapsing toward the sanctuary, except a desire for Jesus in the Holy Eucharist. The reform that's needed, he continued in that interview, is neither to clericalize nor asked to be clericalized. The lay person is a lay person and has to live as a lay person with the power of baptism, which enables that person to be a leaven of love of God in society itself, to create and sow hope, to proclaim the faith, not from a pulpit, but from that person's everyday life. One of the wild fruits that has come from the vine of clericalism, the future Pope said in a book-length interview before he was elected, is a hypercritical spirit that leads some Catholic priests and faithful to expend most of their energy censuring others inside and outside the church, rather than seeking to live and share the joy of the Christian faith. One isn't a good Catholic, the future Pope Francis said, when he's looking only for the negative, for what separates us. This isn't what Jesus wants. Such unredeemed behavior, which is found regularly in personal conversations, blogs, comment boxes, and internet video analyses. How many of you know Michael Voris? Churchmilitant.org. Right? Occasionally he comes up with some very correct analyses, but he always does it bathed in battery acid. That type of hypercriticism mutilates the message of the Christian faith and scares people away from it. Instead, lay people and priests both must become missionary disciples in communion, converted followers of Jesus who, together with others, share the great joy that comes from us from the faith. It's a community of believers trained and inspired to go out and transform politics, society, education, neighborhoods, families, and marriages. It's a brotherhood of good Samaritans drawing near to neighbors with love and mercy. It's faithful who really are the salt of the earth and not just salty critics of the church and everybody else. It's a body of torchbearers radiating Christ's light rather than hiding it within the bushel basket of self-referential, spiritually worldly, and ultimately sick parochial or diocesan structures. That's the third challenge. To not be clericalized, but to go on out as missionaries, because the two are opposites. Fourth challenge, he says, When I say this to teenagers, they like it. It's to make a mess. He says in Spanish, hacer lío. To make some noise, to take some risks, to get a little dirt on your pants. Last September, he gave an interview with America Magazine and Jesuit publications throughout the world. And he said, religious men and women are prophets. A religious must never give up prophecy. And as a Jesuit, he takes this prophetic dimension seriously. And then he gave it greater definition. He said, being prophet sometimes implies making waves. I don't know how else to put it, he said. Prophecy makes noise. It causes an uproar. It makes a mess. Now obviously when we look at the Old Testament prophets, they did make a mess. When we look at St. John the Baptist, he made a mess. Jesus really did make a bloody mess. But that's the type of mess in which we're overturning some of the money-changing tables of the world. When he spoke to Argentinian youth at World Youth Day last year, he said, "Let me tell you what I hope will be the outcome of World Youth Day. I hope there will be a mess, that you'll make some noise. I want the noise to go out. May the bishops and priests forgive me if some of you caused some of this confusion," he said. "But that's my advice. Do whatever you can. Bang some cymbals." Obviously, there's a risk in making a mess and encouraging others to make a mess. But Pope Francis says it's a risk worth taking. If you really want to understand Pope Francis, you've got to grasp this aspect of his courage. He said at the Pentecost vigil last year, "But what happens if we step outside of ourselves? The same thing that can happen to anyone who comes out of the house and goes out onto the street. An accident can happen. But I tell you, I far prefer a church that has had a few accidents to a church that's fallen sick from being closed." You know, we've all seen with hyper-overprotective parents, right? They never let their kids go out, and their kids don't form their freedom. And those are the kids who end up getting, in most cases, into far greater trouble later because of rebellion than a parent who helped the child take the right types of risks in going outside of the home. Same thing happens in a church. Pope Francis wrote in his exhortation last November, "I prefer a church that's bruised, hurting, and dirty because it's been out on the streets, rather than a church that's unhealthy from being confined and from clinging to its own security." What does all of this mean? We're not just going out to cause chaos for the sake of causing chaos. But we've got to be willing to enter into people's darkness if we're going to be able to bring them to Christ. I think the most brilliant thing he's ever said, he said to the bishops in Brazil last year during World Youth Day. He described the whole mission of the church today as the extension of the Emmaus scene in the gospel. You remember what happened in Emmaus. Those two disciples were walking downhill from Jerusalem toward their village called Emmaus, about 7 miles away. They were walking into the dusk. And all of a sudden, an anonymous wayfarer comes up to him and says, "What are you talking about?" And they turn to him and say, "Are you the only person who doesn't know what's happened during these days?" "What things?" "Well, what happened to Jesus of Nazareth? We thought he was a man mighty from God. We had placed our hopes in him. We thought that he was the one. He was the Messiah. He was the one who was going to boot the Romans. But instead, the Romans ended up murdering him in the most ignominious way on a cross. And yet, now we are in the third day since that happened, and some women have appeared and say that he's alive." So then this anonymous companion says, "Oh, how slow you are to understand what Moses and the prophets have taught." And then starting in the Old Testament, he starts to go through how everything in there pointed to the fact that the crucifixion of the Messiah was a validation, not an invalidation, of all that had been taught. Isaac's sacrifice with Abraham pointed to Jesus. The plagues in Egypt and the Passover pointed to Jesus' Passover. The unjust man being beset in the Book of Wisdom pointed to Jesus. Psalm 22, "They could count all my bones, my tongue was thicker than my mouth," that pointed to Jesus. Everything. The suffering servant in Isaiah pointed to Jesus. And as Jesus started to explain this, St. Luke tells us that the hearts of the disciples began to burn. They didn't want it to end. They said, "Stay with us, Lord." And when he broke the bread, that's when they recognized that it was Jesus. Jesus disappeared. They saw him in his real presence. And what was the first thing they did? Even though it was now night, they ran 7 miles uphill in utter darkness just to share that good news with others. Pope Francis says that's a paradigm for spreading the gospel today. He says there are many people wandering away from Jerusalem, and all Jerusalem symbolizes God, the faith, our keeping our end of the covenant. We need, like Jesus, to meet them on that way, even away from church. We need to meet them on that journey and not say, "Where the hell are you going?" But to say, "What are you talking about? What's the big deal for you?" Because Pope Francis says the reasons why they're leaving contain within them the seeds of their return. We saw that with the disciples on the road to Emmaus. They were leaving because they thought the Messiah couldn't be crucified. And when they were shown by Jesus walking along with them that the Messiah had to suffer in this way, that's what led them back. So why do people leave the church? Got a 15-year-old kid who was praying when her grandmother was dying in the hospital that God would save her life. And then grandmother dies. This kid thinks God's cruel. Thinks that God isn't there. That God doesn't listen to prayers even if he exists. And they start to check out in the faith. What's needed in a circumstance like that? What's the seed of the return? You loved your meme. God loves your meme too. You wanted your meme to continue to live. So does God. But the life you wanted your meme to live was eventually going to end here on earth. God wants her to have life that is never going to end. It can start to open them up for that return. Somebody's left the church because of the terrible sexual abuse scandals of the clergy. What's the seed of the return? They know that their clergy is supposed to be holy. And when it's tolerated that you've got priests abusing rather than dying, especially for the lambs entrusted to their care, people are right to be horrified. But when they start to meet somebody who actually is holy, they start to recognize that we judge the church not by those who don't live according to church teachings, but those who do. And they're eventually drawn back like a magnet, because the reason why they were leaving, because of that unholiness and that desire for holiness, starts to draw them back when they find the real holiness. We can encounter lots of these examples. But that's what's needed. To be willing to enter into others' darkness without losing the light with which Christ has illumined us. To be willing to go into those difficult circumstances to meet these people in order to bring them back. When Jesus tells the parable of the lost sheep, you know, in the Holy Land, there were lots of crags all over the country. And to go out after a lost sheep means some of the times climbing on the side of a mountain and then trying to carry a sheep back on your shoulder as you're climbing up the rocks. It was dangerous work. Pope Francis is trying to do that himself personally. He's taken lots of risks. A few times he's gotten burned. But he's asking us to do the same. Fifth challenge is to respond to God's call to receive and share His mercy. The principal message of this papacy has been mercy. His first words upon being asked, "Acceptasne," in the Sistine Chapel. Soon as you get the 2/3 plus 1 and they recount it, you're brought out into the center of the Sistine Chapel, and the one who was in charge of that particular election walks up to you and says, "Acceptasne," Latin, "do you accept?" And normally, the one who has gotten the votes either says "accepto" or "non-accepto." When John Paul II was elected, he said, "trusting in the Lord Jesus Christ and in the prayers and intercession of His Blessed Mother, accepto." What did Cardinal Bergoglio say? "Peccator sum." Said, "in infinita patientia Domini Nostri Jesu Christi, et in spiritu patientiae, accepto." How good your Latin? Okay, just kidding. All right, so, first words, "do you accept?" His response, I'm a sinner, but I trust in the infinite patience of our Lord Jesus Christ, and in a spirit of penance, the papacy is a penance, in a spirit of penance, I accept. First words, peccator sum. His whole motto, miserando atque eligendo, that I've been chosen at the very time that the Lord was merciful to me, communicates this. He got his priestly vocation when, as a 15-year-old boy, he went to 16-year-old boy, he went to confession in Buenos Aires. And in the very act of being forgiven, he recognized that the Lord wanted to send him out with that same capacity to forgive. He said, I am a sinner whom the Lord has looked upon. I always felt my motto, miserando atque eligendo, by having mercy and by choosing him, was very true for me. I was present on that first Sunday after he was elected there in St. Peter's Square when he gave his first Angelus meditation. It was very, very, very powerful. I'll never be able to forget the chills up my spine when he said the chief message of Christianity is God never tires of forgiving us, but it's we who tire of asking for that forgiveness. Then he prayed, may we never tire of asking for what the Lord never tires to give. In a book-length interview prior to the papacy, he said, for me, feeling oneself a sinner is one of the... Fill in the blank there. What would you say? Feeling oneself a sinner is one of the... Most of us in this pop psychological age would say worst experiences we could ever have. Here's what he said. For me, feeling oneself a sinner is one of the most beautiful things that can happen if it leads to its ultimate consequences. Those who don't realize that they're sinners for whom Jesus gave his life to save, they lack the experience of who they are. I believe it's only we great sinners who have this grace. He told a story in that interview, which is very moving. All of us have seen the videos of people jumping off bridges into rivers where people are drowning. We can't watch those videos enough. The heroism that's involved there. He says, our watching these things only becomes more intense when we recognize that the person who jumped on in died saving that person's life. And how much more would it grow if we were the person drowning? He said, but that is our experience of the Christian life. We were drowning in a cesspool of our own sin. And Jesus jumped all the way from heaven to push us to the shore. He himself perished. We know that he rose from the dead, but that shouldn't take away the love that was involved in what Jesus himself did. Jesus died in order to save our life. If somebody else did it for us, we would never be able to stop thanking him and caring for his family. It's so often with Jesus, we take it for granted because we know it turns out well. He says, that's why to understand ourselves as a sinner, it's one of the greatest graces we can have, because we can't appreciate a Savior unless we recognize that we needed to be saved. And that's why he's constantly asking people to come to confession. He said this February, don't be afraid of confession. When one's in line to go to confession, one feels shame sometimes. But then when one finishes confession, one feels free, great, beautiful, forgiven, clean, happy. This is the beauty of confession. I'd like to ask you, he said, when was the last time you made your confession? 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 years, 20 years, 40 years ago? Everyone count, he said. Everyone say, when was the last time I went to confession? And if much time has passed, don't lose another day. Go. The priest will be good. He himself goes every 2 weeks to confession. When was the last time we responded to Pope Francis' challenge to go to confession, to allow Jesus to begin to reform each of us from the inside out? You know, I have a lot of traveling to do because I speak in a lot of places, and I always travel in my blacks. Makes people feel very comfortable that their plane won't go down. But I'm frankly able to do a lot of pastoral work in airports because people don't think I'm ever going to see them again. And, you know, so one of the things that's been happening over the last 19 months is people come up and it's just like, I love your Pope. And when I have a little bit of a chance, I say, how much? What does that mean? How much do you love my Pope? Is he your Pope too? Some of the times they're Catholic, some of the times they're not. A lot of times when they're Catholic, I continue the conversation. So what do you love about him? And he enfleshes the gospel. They'll say lots of true stuff that I can agree with. And then I'll say, do you love him enough? Do you admire him enough? Do you respect him enough to take seriously his greatest appeal and message? Well, what's that, Father? So I'll repeat, Dio non si stanca mai di perdonare. God never tires of forgiving. It's we who tire of asking. May we never tire of asking for what he never tires of giving. Because I think Pope Francis would rather have you hate his guts and follow what he's asking than admire him and ignore what he's asking. You know, it's kind of like that scene in the Acts of the Apostles where the Ethiopian eunuch, servant of Candace, is there in the chariot, and Deacon Philip runs on up and explains the suffering servant of Isaiah and talks about baptism, and then the eunuch stops the carriage and says, there's water right there, what's to stop me from being baptized right now? And he was baptized. And there in airports, people who haven't been to confession for decades say, Father, could you help me to go to confession? That's the power of the message of Pope Francis. When somebody really admires him and takes seriously what he's asking. Sixth challenge is to overcome a personalized and globalized indifference and become truly good Samaritans. To be a Christian is to be a good Samaritan. It's not to be a mediocre human being. It's supposed to be somebody who crosses the road and cares for those who are in need. I see clearly, he said last year in the interview with America, that the thing the church needs most today is the ability to heal wounds and to warm the hearts of the faithful. The church is a field hospital after battle. We've got to heal the wounds. Heal the wounds. The church must be full of people who take responsibility for others and accompany them like a good Samaritan who washes, cleans, and raises up his neighbor. When he went to Lampedusa, that tiny little island off the coast of Sicily last July 7th, where 25,000 people have perished trying to cross over from Africa in just the last 20 years. 25,000 people. He went 2 weeks after a whole boat capsized and pregnant women were being crushed to death by the boat against rocks. He said, nobody knows about Lampedusa. So he went there. He said, can we hear the cries of our people? He said, so often we're like the priest and the Levite in the parable of the Good Samaritan. We see a man or a woman in distress and we say, poor fella. But we don't allow ourselves to be inconvenienced. We keep walking on by. The culture of comfort makes us think that it's not our responsibility. And with that, we feel assuaged. We feel reassured. Makes us think only of ourselves. Makes us insensitive to the cries of other people. Leads to an indifference toward others. In fact, to a globalization of indifference. We've become used to the suffering of others. It no longer affects us. It no longer concerns us. We think it's none of our business. Last September, when he had that prayer vigil for the conflict in Syria, he said, God's world is a world in which we feel responsible for each other, for the other's good. But we have to ask ourselves, is this the world I really desire? Is this the world I carry in my heart? Is this the world I'm living in? Do I really look at myself as my brother's keeper? Or am I like Cain, who thinks that I'm not responsible for my brother's blood? He's calling us in the church to sound an alarm, to wake up the world with our charity. The church needs to lead the reform of the world from globalized indifference to globalized solidarity and charity. The seventh challenge, he said, is to confront our spiritual worldliness. What's spiritual worldliness? It's when we start to place our faith, hope, and love in money or in the things of this world rather than in God. Let me give you a little illustration of what it is. If tonight we had a raffle for $1 million, do you think every woman in Chatham would be here? On Sunday, if we were giving out $1 million, Holy Redeemer would be packed to the rafters. All we offer is God, though, and so many people, including Catholics, have better things to do. We're seeking after the things of this world. And Pope Francis said, we need to lead that revolution. In his pre-conclave intervention, what got him elected as Pope, he said that the greatest evil that afflicts the church is spiritual worldliness, which means living within herself, of herself, and for herself. This leads to a sense of self-sufficiency, living by the spirit of the world rather than by the spirit of Jesus. He said in that apostolic exhortation that it causes us to live a life, you'll love this phrase, he said it a few paragraphs after, he said that we always have to speak clearly and simply. And here's what he came out with. He said, we begin to live as self-absorbed Promethean semi-Pelagians. Totally clear and simple. Everybody got it? What does that mean? Self-absorbed, I think you know. Okay, we're focused on our own concerns. Prometheus was the figure in Greek mythology who had received from Zeus the power of fire. But he began to think that that power was his own. He no longer related it to Zeus. He was using it for his own purposes. He had forgotten God, turned his back on the gods. And semi-Pelagianism? Pelagianism was a 5th century heresy that said we didn't need God. We'd be saved by our own works, our own effort. Semi-Pelagianism said we need God just that much. We need a little bit of grace. But it's like 99% our effort, 1% God. Right? That's spiritual worldliness. Even in our parishes, a lot of times we can focus so much on budgets and institutional stuff, then we forget about the real mission of the church. We start to live self-absorbed. We think that all the talents that God's given us, our own fire, is for our own purposes, that God gave us brains so that we could get rich, so that we could make a name for ourselves rather than sanctify His name, build our kingdom rather than His, do our will rather than His. And that we exclude God in real agency, forgetting that almost everything we do, we're doing because He's helping us to do it. That's spiritual worldliness. And it infects everything. In fact, he says, even our liturgy sometimes, where we begin to focus so much on what we're doing that we're blind to what God's doing. We've got to turn that around. This is a particular challenge for us in the highly organized, institutionally wealthy parishes and churches of the West. It's easy for us sometimes to say, as long as we're paying our bill, everything's fine. Pope Francis is saying, that's spiritually worldly. And many bishops and many cardinals and many priests and many Catholics were more spiritually worldly than remind people of Jesus Christ. You know, the great criticism of Paul VI of American cardinals during his own time, where they were all businessmen, more than men of God. That was their reputation in general. We need to fight against it because it's a temptation. 8th challenge is to overcome, he says, the ferocious idolatry of money, which leads to a culture of waste in which people are discarded. What does he mean by that? I already gave you a little of example of what we'd show up for. We'd show up for the million, but we won't show up for God. He says so much of our culture is based on the reassumption of the worship of the ancient golden calf. That worship of the golden calf is returned in a new and ruthless guise in the idolatry of money, in the dictatorship of an impersonal economy lacking a truly human purpose. When he was in Brazil last year, he gave an interview with the Brazilian main television station there. He said, the world in which we're living has fallen into a ferocious idolatry of money. Ferox is that Latin word for fox. It's going to eat you alive. There's a worldwide policy dominated by the pursuit of money. Money's now in control. What happens as a result of this? When the ferocious idolatry of money reigns, everything for the most part focuses on the center and those on the extreme of society, the young who aren't working yet, Seniors who are too old to work, the handicapped who can't work, are badly taken care of, neglected, and discarded. We don't have room for them anymore because they're no longer productive in an economic model. Using a story of a rabbi from the 12th century, he says a lot that there was a story among the rabbis that as they were building the Tower of Babel, it would take a long time. They didn't have ovens for the bricks the same way that we would have today. So it took a lot of work making the bricks and baking the bricks. And when you take them all the way up to try to place the brick in, if a brick fell from its high promontory and broke, everybody would be devastated. But if a human being fell, they'd just replace him by another worker. A lot of the times that's what happens. Money reigns rather than serves. Pope Francis isn't against capitalism. He isn't against the free markets, despite some of the headlines you may have read. But what he is against is an anthropology, an understanding of the human person in which we're a cog of a machine rather than the whole goal of the economy. That the economy is supposed to serve the human person, not the other way around. He said in that apostolic exhortation, how can it not be a news item when an elderly person dies homeless of exposure, but it's news when the stock market loses 2 points. Ninth challenge is to overcome our tendency to turn our faith into an ideology. That happens when we begin to isolate certain parts of our faith from Jesus and from the faith as a whole. He said, ideological religion becomes an obstacle to true faith. The faith passes through a distiller. Ideologies don't bring people together. In ideologies, Jesus isn't present. It's his tenderness, his love, his meekness. When a Christian becomes a disciple of an ideology, he's lost the faith. He's no longer a disciple of Jesus. He's a disciple of an attitude of thought. What does this mean? We see it with the Pharisees and the scribes in the gospel. They started to become ideologues of the law. Such that if you weren't washing your hands in this way, cutting an eggshell in half, taking a half eggshell of water, pouring it down over your fingers this way, making a fist, trying to clean your hands that way, and then taking another eggshell of water and pouring it down the other way and doing the same thing. If you weren't doing that, you weren't faithful. That's why they were complaining to Jesus that his disciples weren't washing hands. That's the way they did it. They started to focus so much on these little things that Jesus said, they were straining out a gnat and swallowing a camel. We need to focus on those weightier things. So some of the times we can become so angry in our faith, for example, with the way, for example, the Democratic Party doesn't support life, or the Republican Party doesn't adequately support programs for the poor, that we can become more political than faithful, frankly. We can start to focus on individual issues, which are important, so much that we lose the sense of a whole. And Pope Francis says this is a big-time problem, and it's the source of many of the disputes in the Church. He says, making the gospel message an ideology is a temptation that's been present in the Church from the beginning. It's an attempt to interpret the gospel apart from the gospel itself and apart from the Church. It's contrary to looking at everything with the eyes of a disciple. What are some of these ideologies, he says? First one is sociological reductionism, in which we start to look at our faith from sociological lenses. Just looking at, for example, what people say they want the Church to teach rather than what the Church teaches. We always get those polls. That's one example of a sociological reductionism. Well, if 80% of Catholics want to change in this, well, then the Church should do it. Right? That's an ideology. Psychologizing, he says. Reducing spirituality to stages of growth of self-awareness in our encounters with Christ. Again, we reduce everything to psychology. He says, Gnostic solutions, making Christianity too much a thing of the head knowledge of a higher disembodied spirituality rather than a way of life. You know, we had that with the parable of the Good Samaritan, right? The lawyer who came up knew what he needed to do. You need to love God with all you got, love your neighbor as yourself. But Jesus said to him, not know this and you will live, but do this and you will live. And then he tells the whole parable of Good Samaritan. He says, go and do likewise. It's not a thing of the head. It's not what we know. Thanks be to God, we don't all have to have PhDs in theology to get to heaven. He says the Pelagian solution, in which it's all based on our own work and our own organization. The functional solution that fixes processes and aims at efficiency, but which makes the church basically a non-governmental organization, an NGO, focused on quantifiable results and statistics. One example of that, when I was at Bishop Connolly High School in Fall River as the chaplain, they had a community service requirement. So I came on in and I said, what crimes did they commit? And they didn't get the joke. What do you mean, Father? Isn't it good that they're out helping? I said, it's great that they're out helping the poor. It's great that they're doing this type of stuff. But we actually do Christian charity. The judge assigns community service. It's a big difference. Mother Teresa used to say, if all that we're doing is community service, I'm moving my sisters out of here. Because we do something different. But some of the time, service can become an ideology. Tenth and last challenge, which I don't think I have to ponder too much, is to overcome the culture of gossip. There's one thing Pope Francis has talked about more than any and every other thing. It's the culture of gossip. Because everything starts there. We can become Cains, killing our brother and sister Abels with our tongue, lacerating him down, spreading false stuff about him. It happens in the Curia all the time. I lived in Rome for 6 years. It's rampant there. He's battling it at home, but he's trying to spread it throughout the entire world. He's been a victim of it. You remember as soon as he was elected, right? You had those two priests whose lives he rescued, but who were still holding a grudge because they were Marxist, and they didn't feel supported in their ideas down there. And so they were trying to basically say that he had turned them over to this military junta in Argentina, whereas in fact he was the guy who risked his life to go free them. But the media was spreading all of that because they just wanted basically to cut his legs out at the beginning, kill his authority. Rumors there without really fact-checking. But this culture of gossip goes way beyond Vatican or bureaucratic or political institutions. It's such a large part of our culture that many of us no longer even notice it. Many newspapers, television, news and entertainment programs, radio talk shows, and blogs have all become tabloid, dedicating much of their coverage to the latest dirt or hardships facing those in public life. We think we have a right to know other people's dirty laundry. Political parties and candidates spend increasing resources in opposition research, focusing not just on the legitimate investigation of an opponent's past positions, public votes, and actions, but also on the nefarious strip mining of the person's or his or her family's private life all the way back to kindergarten. The most insidious and widespread form of gossip of all, however, is what normally takes place at office water coolers, or school corridors or playgrounds, certain websites or social media tools, or sometimes even parish meetings. Gossip has gone global, and it hurts not only its objects and subjects, but collaterally damages families, neighborhoods, communities, parishes, and the church, and culture as a whole. So Pope Francis has been putting it into his crosshairs and really going after it. He begs, by the grace of the Holy Spirit, that we will succeed in never gossiping. What a huge step forward that will be for all of us, and it will do us so much good. Rumors are destructive in the church, he said. It's like the spirit of Cain killing his brother. He said that gossiping Catholics become Christians of good manners and bad habits, appearing on the outside to be faithful, but viciously cutting others down. He said that there are three types. First, we supply misinformation, giving only half truths so that others will draw a false impression of another. This often happens in politics. Second, we engage in defamation, what the church normally calls detraction. When a person truly has a flaw and it's big, they tell it, just like a yellow journalist does, and the character of this person is ruined. We can all behave like tabloid journalists, airing the dirty laundry of others in public, he said. You know, where did we see this last month? We saw it from the Diocese of Peoria, Illinois. I don't know if you followed any of this stuff with Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen's cause for beatification, but the Diocese of Peoria decides to shut the whole thing down because it's not getting its way in getting the body of Archbishop Sheen to be sent from St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York back to Peoria, Illinois. There's a disagreement there. Sometimes there are disagreements. There have always been disagreements. But Peoria puts it out as if it were New York shutting it down in a first press release. So I wrote a couple articles setting the record straight on that one. Peoria put out another press release, and in the second press release, after New York had said, we're going to allow you to come in and examine the body here in New York, and we'll see about what relics you're going to be able to take back, they put out for public consumption a letter that the lawyer from New York had sent June 27, basically saying, because we're upset with the way that you're behaving, we're not going to let you examine and exhume the body. Now, that had already been changed publicly by the Archdiocese of New York the previous day. And for Peoria to put that into public consumption was for the sole reason of trying to poison people's impressions of the Archdiocese of New York, Cardinal Dolan in particular. Pure and simple detraction. Pope Francis is saying, doesn't exist, and so many people have been scandalized by what's been happening with the Sheen thing. And the third type, he says, is slander, of saying things that are just not true. He says all three of these are sins. They are sins. It's to slap Jesus in the person of his children, his brothers. Whatever we do to the least of Christ's brothers, we do to him, the Pope said. And to gossip about anyone is to gossip and hurt Christ himself. So these are 10 challenges Pope Francis is making to us all. Like his namesake, St. Francis, whose feast day we celebrated last week, Pope Francis recognizes that reform of institutional flow charts is insufficient because there needs to be a renewal of the men and women, the boys and girls, the clerics, the religious, the laity, sinners all, but hopefully on the way to becoming saints that comprise the church. These 10 aspects of the reform are an important part of that reshaping. And Pope Francis is hoping and praying that we'll all be part of that transformation, so that together with him we can take the good news out to all, including those on the peripheries all around us, and help them to come to know together with us our Holy Redeemer in this world, so that together we can rejoice in his presence forever. Praise be Jesus Christ.